This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. Donal Kavanagh with you on till 12 noon today. Now, we read over the weekend that children's spinal surgery may be outsourced abroad as waiting lists double. Children's Health Ireland apologises to children and their families as new figures show waiting lists approaching a five-year high. This issue has been highlighted by a number of people, including Deputy David Cullinan, who is Sinn Féin's health spokesperson. Deputy Cullinan, good morning.
Good morning, Donald.
Deputy, is this good news in that the children are going to get their surgery done, or is it bad news in terms of it being an indictment of the system?
Well, we have to go back, first of all, to 2017 when Simon Harris was Minister for Health, and he gave a very clear commitment on RT Radio at the time and subsequently in the Dáil Chamber in statements in the Dáil on this issue of scoliosis and spina bifida procedures, that no child with scoliosis or spina bifida would have to wait longer than 4 months for the very complex but life-changing surgery which those children need. And my understanding is that was based on a plan that was put in place by the then head of the HSE, Tony O'Brien, the Minister for Health and other health officials and the head of the acute hospital services. And the plan was to essentially do two things. One, to increase capacity in this state, and there are three hospitals that provide these procedures: Kappa Hospital, Temple Street and Crumlin, with the majority of the procedures carried out in Temple Street and Crumlin and a small number in Kappa. And the second part of the plan was to outsource services where possible to specialist hospitals in England, in France and in Germany. That scheme was put in place in 2018, and some parents availed of it. So it was offered to as many parents and children that could avail of it or wanted to avail of that option. And it did seem to reduce the waiting list at the time. And for me, it made sense at a time when capacity was being built up, and we do need to increase surgical theatre capacity and hire more specialists to carry out the procedures. Everything and anything that can be done should be done to ensure that those children have speedy access to services. But what seems to have happened is that the waiting list came down quite substantially in 2019 as a result of this outsourcing, which was good news. But then for some reason, that scheme was stopped in mid-2019, and the waiting list started to creep back up again and got to a point where we now have, as you said, a five-year high. And many children waiting up to 5 years in some cases for these procedures.
Obviously, we've had COVID in the middle there, and that, you know, COVID will have had a huge impact, particularly, I suppose, when you're worried about cross-contamination and sending people to hospitals abroad. Now, have we got to the point where there were valid reasons for saying COVID was interrupting things in 2020 and 2021, but now we're in 2023, COVID sometimes still gets used as the coverall reason for something happening, or the coverall reason for something not happening, as the case may be. And the argument is, well, hang on a tick now, lads, we're well out of COVID at this stage. This really shouldn't be an issue anymore.
Well, first of all, the scheme was stopped well before COVID. So COVID arrived in early 2020. This scheme was ceased, I think, very early in 2019. So for whatever reason, that decision was made. And obviously, health services have been open now for quite some time, since COVID has not been the issue that it was in 2021. So for whatever reason, the scheme was stopped in 2019, but then wasn't reinstated again post-COVID, I suppose, in terms of health services opening up again. And that's a question for the Minister for Health to answer. What I want to do is to ensure that those parents and children have the best option for access to services. So, of course, travelling abroad is not ideal. And you ask the question, is it good news? It's welcome insofar as it provides an option for parents. And in my view, every option should be on the table. So, of course, if we can get through these very high numbers and wait times for those children, then every option should be offered to those parents. It seems that the Minister for Health is now only looking at this since I and others in opposition, but also the media, have been asking questions and looking at the figures. And I've spoken to people who were involved in this scheme, and they're puzzled as well as to why the outsourcing was ceased in 2019. But equally, Donald, we have to ask the question in relation to that promise and commitment that was given in 2017 by Simon Harris was on the back of a plan, and it was underpinned by a plan to increase capacity in this state. And it seems that all of the capacity that was promised has not been delivered, including a fifth operating theatre in Temple Street, which was due to open last November, and for whatever reason is still not open. And we're hearing it might be this winter before it's open, but again, no guarantees. So it does seem to be very slow in putting in place the capacity, because it was 6 years ago in 2017 when that promise was made. And at the end of all of this, we have children who are waiting and waiting and waiting. And you might have seen a number of months ago, there was a report from the Ombudsman for Children that looked through the lens of one child called Ivy, called Ivy in the report. It's not a real name. But that child was waiting 5 years. And that report laid bare a litany of broken promises, of failures in the system to communicate with our parents, of false starts in relation to when the parents were told the child would have surgery. And ultimately, it was a very, very stark report and a damning report, which again underlined a lot of the promises that were made simply have not been delivered. And I think they are reasonable and genuine questions that the Minister for Health now has to answer. Why was the capacity not put in quick enough? And why was that option of going abroad stopped in 2019?
And a point that does have to be made, and many of us, I'm sure, will have heard various children speaking on national radio and TV, and indeed they've been on this programme as well, where the level of pain that some children with scoliosis are going through on a regular and constant basis doesn't bear thinking about. That these are not just statistics, these are children in pain. And I think that needs to be said again. Children in pain. Constant pain. And they are being left, as we say, for 5 years. Now, to my mind, if my child were in pain, I wouldn't want my child left in pain for 5 minutes, not to mention 5 weeks or 5 months or 5 years.
Well, I think any parent listening to this programme of a child would know that you would do absolutely anything and go to the ends of the earth to ensure that your child gets the treatment that they need. And you're right, that the pain that these children go through, and spinal pain for any person, but particularly a young child, is chronic, and it's awful for that family to have to watch their child in pain for as long as many of those children are in. And I've met many of them, it has to be said, over the course of the last number of years. And I don't claim for one second that the Minister for Health doesn't care about these issues, because I've spoken to him directly about this issue. We've debated this issue upside down and inside out on the Dáil. We have always said that we want to work with the government, to work with the minister, to ensure that the capacity is put in. It is complex because it is a very specialist service. You need specialist surgeons and staff. But the point also has to be made that this hasn't just happened over the course of the last number of months or short number of years. This has been an issue in this state for a long, long number of years. And when Simon Harris made that commitment in 2017, that was on the back of years of parents campaigning for better services. So for the best part of 10 years or more, we have known that we have serious problems in this state in providing this service to children with spina bifida and scoliosis. And it shouldn't take this long, and it shouldn't be beyond us. When a commitment was given, as real as it was in 2017, that no child would have to wait longer than 4 months. And that was part of a plan that was thought out in terms of what was needed. And yet, for whatever reason, 6 years on, that capacity is not being put in, and the option for treatment abroad seems to have ceased. And I think that's a major mistake, and the minister needs to answer why that happened. But right now, we need to reinstate that scheme. We need to offer that as an option to parents, and we need to bring much more urgency to delivering the additional capacity. And just make an additional point. Ultimately, the new National Children's Hospital will be a game changer for these children. When it's built, and the problem is we have no timescale, and we can provide no certainty as to when that hospital will build, but it will double the number of operating theatres that exist for children's surgeries, and it will for the first time provide what's called protected capacity, because part of the problem in Temple Street and Crumlin is that while these are very complex surgeries, they are planned procedures and scheduled procedures, and when you have unplanned or unscheduled presentations and emergencies, they take precedence, and very often these procedures then can be cancelled at the last minute, which is obviously awful for those children.
Vital so, too that we also have the qualified staff, because it's also vital that we have the qualified staff, because we will need we'll have registrars and others, but we will need consultants and specific paediatric orthopaedic consultants, because whereas I'm sure general orthopaedic surgeons do have skills, there would be very specific skills needed by a paediatric orthopaedic surgeon to carry out these, as you say, complex surgeries, and we will want to ensure that there are sufficient paediatric orthopaedic surgeons employed at that children's hospital that have the skill and have the expertise to carry out the surgeries. Because for so often we've heard, oh, we have the theatres, but we don't have the consultants, we don't have the qualified staff. We're going to have to get this one right from the off.
No, and that's right, but I've spoken to a number of surgeons who work in the different hospitals, and a number of them have been before the Oireachtas Health Committee on a number of occasions and have been campaigning themselves for increased capacity. So this is one of the areas where you have leading consultants who specialise in this area, who, while they are trying to provide as many procedures as possible and work around the clock to ensure that these children get the services that they need, they also have had to spend time campaigning, coming before Oireachtas hearings and answering questions from the media. That's not what they need to be doing. They need to concentrate on doing the procedures. And they say that it is possible to ramp up capacity. They have presented plans themselves, particularly those surgeons in Kappa Hospital who submitted capital funding plans to increase capacity. So they say it is possible to not only hire the consultants, but all of the allied healthcare professionals. Part of the problem is we don't have the surgical theatre capacity. So you can have as many surgeons as is required, but if you don't have the operating theatre capacity and you have emergencies that then clash with scheduled care and there's cancellations, which happens routinely across the health service. But when it happens here in these specialist surgeries, it becomes much more problematic. So it isn't that the current consultants and staff feel there is no solution or it's more complex than it is. They accept it is complex, but they also will be critical of the slow pace of progress and the fact that many of their funding requests options haven't been delivered by government. And I think that's, again, a question for the Minister for Health to answer. And I'm not claiming, Don Lanny, if this is easy, but I think most reasonable people listening to your programme will say that 6 years on from a promise that was given, that's enough time and sufficient time to put the capacity in. And it seems that we failed. And I go back to the report from the Ombudsman from Children. It was a report which basically talked about broken promises and a litany of broken promises. And it's hard to disagree with that analysis from the Ombudsman.
Deputy David Cullinan, thanks indeed for speaking to us this morning. Sinn Féin's health spokesperson. I just want to say a very happy birthday to Chloe Caulfield of Crown Heights in Lifford. Happy birthday, Chloe. And that's from Auntie Brigine and Derek as well. So a very, very happy birthday indeed to Chloe Caulfield there in Lifford. Now, before we go for a break, just a few of your comments. Please let your listeners know on the Cranford corners, there's oil on the road. Thankfully, I was going at a snail's pace. A car skidded. Thanks, don't want to see an accident happening in the area. Now, another caller says we spoke to Grania on our Gartha slot earlier about the e-scooters. I live in Buncrana. They zoom past us on footpaths without even a warning. They're very dangerous in our roads. I'm happy to hear this news. Another caller says, I was at the county league final in McCool Park on Sunday. St Eunan's were playing Naef Connell. Martin Regan, the Dlenthes manager, was brilliant in the way he achieved his win, used his bench brilliantly for their capability rather than who they were. This man should be headhunted for the Donegal job. Brilliant manager. Well, that's certainly food for thought, I'm sure, for the team who are tasked with securing a new manager for Donegal. Now it is 20 past 11. Going to take a short break. Back after these.
The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And the time on Highland Radio is 22 minutes past 11 o'clock. Now, domestic violence leave is set to be formally introduced this autumn with the publication of regulations setting out the rate of pay and guidance for employers currently being developed by Women's Aid. The new form of leave was introduced as part of the Work-Life Balance Act, which was passed earlier this year. Delighted to be joined on Zoom by Minister Roderick O'Gorman, the Minister for Equality. Minister, good morning.
Good morning, Donal. How are you keeping?
Very well indeed. This is an important measure because what we're doing is effectively, hopefully, taking one worry away from people who are in a very worrying and distressing situation.
Yeah, absolutely. As you know, we passed the Work-Life Balance Act earlier this year in April, and that provides a range of new rights for employees. And one of these rights is the right for someone who is a victim of domestic violence to seek 5 days paid leave from their work. And what we're announcing today is that that leave will be paid at 100% of the rate of their wage or salary. Some leaves, for example, like sick pay, for example, is paid at 70% of the rate of pay. But I suppose domestic violence leave is unique. It is trying to support a victim and particularly protect them from poverty at a particularly difficult time for them. So that's why we made a decision to pay it at 100% the rate. So this new leave will kick in autumn of this year.
Obviously, this is going to take very careful consideration. And as you said, Women's Aid are very much involved in that process, because we're dealing with something which is intensely personal and intensely private to the person who is seeking that leave. So it's different in that respect from sick leave or maternity leave and other forms of leave. This is a very intensely private and traumatic thing. And the privacy of people is going to have to be paramount here, isn't it?
It's important, and I know that privacy issue was a concern for both the domestic violence NGOs. It was also a concern for the businesses as well and their representatives. So we've tried to do this in a balanced way, so individuals don't have to bring form proof of the particular abuse that they've suffered. They just have to claim that they have to inform their employer that they're seeking this domestic violence leave. And even that, I recognise, can be a big step for some employees. So that's why, working with Women's Aid, we're looking to put in place a range of policy supports for employers to allow them, I suppose, design their response in a way that gives encouragement to their employees to feel that they are in a position to raise what, as you said, is a really delicate and sensitive issue. And I think we recognise, as a country now, there has been a real stigma around domestic violence, and part of removing that stigma is, I suppose, enabling and empowering employees to feel that they can raise it with their employer, say they're in this situation, and seek this particular type of leave.
Have you any projections as to how many people you expect to take up this leave? I mean, and is this here for the long term now? Is this going to become a permanent feature, or is this being done on a pilot basis?
It's not being done on a pilot basis, but we have built into the law a requirement for it to be reviewed in 2 years' time to, I suppose, give us an indication of its take-up, of its effectiveness. Normally, new laws are addressed maybe after 5 years, but we thought, because this is A, particularly important, but B, quite novel, we're going to be one of the first European countries to introduce paid leave for victims of domestic violence. It has been introduced in New Zealand and Australia already, but it isn't something that's a feature of Europe. So that's why we're having this this review after 2 years, just to look at take-up rates and look at any other potential barriers that become apparent to its take-up.
Caller asking if this leave covers men as well. Caller says some statistics suggesting 1/3 of victims of domestic violence are men. Presumably men too can apply for this?
Absolutely, yeah. It's non-gender specific. It recognises that women and men can be victims of domestic violence.
How important is it that Women's Aid are involved in this process, in terms of how it's going to be administered and how it's going to be structured, that you have the experts advising you and your own officials to make sure that, you know, the various issues potentially with this law are got right and got right now?
Well, look, we've had consultation with domestic violence NGOs and indeed with the social partners throughout this process. We had consultation with them when we were drafting the Work-Life Balance Bill itself. We've just finished a consultation with them in terms of the rate of pay. And actually, I revised the law to make sure that the voices of NGOs would be heard when I or future ministers make determinations about the rate of pay. And now Women's Aid are involved in terms of getting those supports for businesses. So I think in an issue like this, where we know there are organisations in Ireland that has a huge range of knowledge, a huge range of expertise, I think it has been really beneficial to have their input.
Minister, while I have you, I know you're also the minister that has responsibility for asylum seekers and for those from Ukraine and elsewhere who are in our country seeking asylum and seeking refuge. A difficult couple of years, I'm sure, for you in your ministry and some very difficult challenges you've had to face. How do you feel about where we are at the moment in terms of the services we're providing for asylum seekers and refugees?
Well, we're the state is directly providing accommodation for 70,000 Ukrainians and just over 22,000 international protection applicants. So this is a huge number of people, over 90,000 people. And it's, I suppose, contrasted to January 2022 when we were accommodating 8,000 people. So it's a massive increase in terms of the state's responsibility. It's a response to a war in the European continent, something none of us anticipated in January 2022. I think by and large, Ireland has done well in its response. And I think that response has been enabled by, I suppose, the generosity of individuals and communities all over the country who have opened their hearts, opened their communities to Ukrainians, to refugees fleeing from other countries, and supported them, supported their integration. Look, undoubtedly, Donal, there have been challenges when you're trying to accommodate that number of people while the country is, as we already well know, facing a housing shortage. It is difficult, but I suppose, you know, every now and then a country is tested, and Ireland and indeed all European countries are being tested right now in terms of the biggest movement of people across the European continent since the Second World War.
Finally, one of your stated objectives has always been to end direct provision and find another method of administering accommodation for asylum seekers while they are here and going through the process. How are you in terms of, or where are you in that process of finding a replacement for direct provision?
Well, the very significant increases in the number of people seeking direct provision here, seeking international protection here, has obviously changed the landscape entirely. When we published the white paper in January 2021, we expected to be dealing with maybe 3,500-4,000 people seeking international protection every year. Last year, we had 15,000 people seeking international protection. So in terms of our accommodation response, we're going to have to redesign that. And we are just trying to get accommodation for people right now. But I think it's important to note that the white paper had other elements as well, elements around integration and elements around supports. And we've done a lot over the last 3 years to improve the integration of international protection applicants. They can now work after 6 months. They can get a bank account. They can get a driver's license. But we're also supporting local authorities. So, for example, as of this summer, my department are financing a local authority integration team. So four new employees in every local authority to support the integration of international protection applicants. And we're really appreciative of the engagement we've had with local authorities across the country. We're putting in place particular supports to the CIPSEs, the Children and Young Persons Services Committees, so they can support.
Minister, thank you very much indeed. I want to give a quick comment before we go. We were speaking earlier to Paula Leonard, and Paula referenced the sweet cigarettes that used to be on sale. And a caller says, I work in a shop and Kennedy cigarettes are now available and they're being sold in Barbie and Batman packaging. Another caller queries why non-alcohol drinks are stored outside of the off-licence section in supermarkets. If those drinks are inappropriate for underage consumption, should they not be stocked with the alcoholic products? And Paula Leonard did make the point that the difference between the legislation here and the legislation in, say, Scandinavian countries is here ban is specifically related to the product. So you have to put the alcoholic beer in a special section. You have to advertise alcoholic beer in a certain way. So whereas, for instance, we'll just take the brand name of Carlsberg. So Carlsberg lager has got to be treated in a certain way. But Carlsberg Zero, or whatever the name of its non-alcohol variant is, Carlsberg Zero is treated differently because the ban is on the product, it's not on the name. Whereas in other areas, the ban is on the name Carlsberg. Now, for instance, when I was in Denmark a few years back, I was drinking bottled water that was branded Carlsberg, because Carlsberg obviously is a major brewery in Copenhagen. There is actually bottled water that is branded Carlsberg in Denmark, for instance, which I found interesting, with regards to candy cigarettes still being on sale. I'm sure they're probably called something else now. They're probably called candy sticks, and they don't have the little red glow at the end. But, I mean, you know, when I was young, they were called sweet cigarettes, and that's what they were called. They'll be called something else, I'm sure, now. But, you know, to have something even vaguely resembling cigarettes in Barbie packaging is worrying, to say the least. Now, we're going to take a very short break, and when we come back, we're going to be speaking about a very important fundraising initiative for Cancer Care West. Don't go away.
The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
This is Donald Kavanagh on the 9 till noon show this morning. One of the things we're blessed with in Donegal is the range of supports for people who are going through a cancer battle. And a very important one is Cancer Care West. They have a base in Letterkenny. And one of its patrons is Noel Cunningham. And Noel joins us on the line because next month, we see the third Donegal Camino in support of Cancer Care West. And Noel and colleagues will be doing a lot of walking on that particular trail. Noel, a very good morning to you.
And a very good morning to you. And, you know, what you've just said there, it dovetails very nicely into where I am, because I drove through Inishowen this morning on the way to the Clonmany show, another showcase of everything that's great about Donegal. It's on today and tomorrow. And the Donegal Camino, whilst it is raising funds for that incredible cancer centre in Letterkenny, which does extraordinary work, it is also a showcase of our beautiful Donegal, the scenery, the people. And when I say the people, as we walk, we encourage communities to come out and welcome us. And maybe there's the odd surprise guest, a well-known face. It's just one of those extraordinary events. And I'll use that word again and again, and I'm sorry, but I make no apology for it, because the path we will sort of follow, you know, the tracks we will walk, like Malin Head, Knockalla. Can you imagine Hornhead? Mm. We're doing a sunrise at Errigal, the beautiful island of Torrey, Mahara down in beautiful Ardrah, and we finish, as always, on our spectacular, wonderful, beautiful Slieve League. It's just an incredible event where people join, they have fun and laughter, food, song, music, crack, while raising money for a great cause. And the support we've had in the past years has been phenomenal. And it continues to grow, Donal, and it's just very exciting.
And the numbers taking part in the walk, registration still open. I'm sure a significant number of people have already registered. And if more wish to join you, they're welcome. It takes place from the 3rd to the 9th of September.
Oh, absolutely. We are encouraging others to register. The only thing I would say is, please do it as soon as possible, because registration, for various reasons, logistical, for insurance, for different purposes and reasons, will have to close on the 20th of August. And most importantly, people do not have to walk the entire week. You know, they can dip in and dip out and choose, for example, the days and the routes that they would most like to sort of walk. And that's a nice way of doing it, because not everybody can give up a full week. And on that point as well, we should mention, just in the past and this year, Gallagher's Bakehouse, Fáilte Ireland and Donegal Tourism are really so supportive with kind of sponsorship. Mm-hmm. And like last year, Harvey's Point, Vodafone Donegal, they jumped on the bandwagon and helped us out and gave us money, because what we're trying to do is offset some of the expenses that we have no option. They have to be covered, like insurance, like guides, but everything else. And the wonderful Peggy Stringer, whose idea was to walk the hills of Donegal for Cancer Care West, Deirdre McGlone, well, I need nobody be told who she is.
Yes, an old friend of yours.
Absolutely. And Noreen Darcy, who has a PR company in Galway, and she has become an honorary Donegal woman. And in fact, we have walkers from all over France, Scotland, England. You know, it's really a very international affair now. But as I say, again, Harvey's Point are coming on board this year to help us out. I am sure Vodafone Donegal will do the same, because Tim and Jacinta not only give us a lovely donation to sponsor, but they also walk with us. You know, it's very hard in a short radio interview to really just say how magical it all is. And very importantly, we all have enough friends out there to help us raise a bit of personal sponsorship. So anybody who's walking, who is listening, I will say to them, if they want some ideas for how to raise the money or a sponsorship card, because, you know, registration's only €30 per day, which is a very reasonable, a very small amount. And what really boosts the coffers of Cancer Care West is if people join the walk having gathered, you know, some sponsorship.
Yeah.
And today, for example, we had somebody out of the blue who said, I'm coming to do the walk. I've already raised quite a sizable amount of money, and I'm going to divide it between yourselves and another very good cause. So that's the kind of spirit we're trying to kind of really and truly enthuse about and encourage people. And Donal, yourselves and Highland Radio, I can't thank you enough, because, as I say, to get the message out in our beloved Donegal, and as I say, a showcase for our beloved Donegal, some of the most spectacular scenery in the world, it's very gracious of you to always answer the call and let me come on and babble on about some event or other that is usually raising money for people who do wonderful work in our community and beyond.
Well, Noel, you're always welcome on this program and on this radio station, you know that. And in fairness to yourself, Noel, as a prominent a member of the Donegal Camino Committee and a prominent participant, a lot of people who are supporters and patrons of organisations like this will go to the start of the walk, and they'll walk the first K or two. And they'll go to the end and they'll walk the last K or two, perhaps, and they'll get the photographs in between. You, in fairness, do pretty much most of the walk yourself, don't you?
Oh, God almighty, let me tell you something. It would be a source of incredible embarrassment if Deirdre or Peggy or Noreen or myself decided to just smile at the registration,
yeah,
take the money and run. We don't operate like that.
Absolutely not.
You will see me on the top of Errigal, please God. You will see me with Deirdre singing, you know, back home to Donegal on the top of Slieve League. We will be looking toward the beautiful sea and ocean at Malinhead. Yes, no, we walk. We are
absolutely
part of it.
Absolutely.
It's more of a community walk. God, I wouldn't dream of not being part
absolutely
of it. It's too magical.
And that's a lead into my next question, because we've all, those of us who live in Donegal, or most of us who live in Donegal, we've all driven those roads, we've all driven those routes, we've all been to those places. But I'm sure it's very, very different to walk it than it is to drive it. You'll get to appreciate so much more the scenery, get to appreciate so much more the atmosphere, the fresh air. I mean, it must be very, very different. I mean, I'll be honest, I've driven the loop around Malinhead, I've driven, you know, down around Knockalla, but I've never walked them. And I'm sure it's a very, very different and very fulfilling experience to do so.
When we drive, we're watching the road by and large, or we're chatting to somebody in the car and people are chatting to the driver. When you walk anywhere, and I'll give the example of, say, the Camino, when you gather at Bamba's Crown and walk along that cliff face, and there's nothing between you and the United States except stunning scenery behind, in front, above, you just have no option but to be just drawn into that amazing and wonderful spectacle, and appreciate and let your troubles disappear with the light breeze, you know? And as I said, when I was driving over to Clonmany this morning, just to drive through Inishowen, I slow down and I stop. And funny, I know Deirdre McGlone, she tends to do that sometimes. I just pull in to just look and say, oh my goodness gracious me, don't we live in the most beautiful county? So yes, to walk is to see it in its real, raw, and most beautiful state. And if I can just get another little plug in there, if anybody has any questions and they happen to be at the Clonmany show, then just please do stop me and ask me, because you hear my enthusiasm for it. And of course, they can go online, donegalcamino.ie. Third to the 9th of September, you can, as I say, come in, drop out as you see fit. And I always say this, don't panic if you're not a walker. We had a lovely lady last year who hadn't walked in years. She was very nervous. Would she be able for it? She did every walk, every single day, and at the end admitted that she could have done another week. So don't be fearful that we're hiking up the side of Carn Tuathail. It's not like that. We have slightly longer walks mixed in with shorter walks. Very doable. Very, 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 I won't say easy, but suitable for all grades of walkers. So don't have any fear about joining us.
Before I let you go, Noel, one question has come in, and that's the question of accommodation, particularly if someone is travelling to the county. Are there accommodation options in the various areas, and can that be organised through yourself?
Absolutely. No. We give people a wonderful, as I say, on the DonegalCamino.ie, or if they want to contact us directly. We have a list of providers all over our beautiful county, not just for bed, for breakfast, but restaurants as well. We ask people to make their own arrangements, because otherwise it becomes complicated and labour intensive. But yes, a lot of people do choose the recommended accommodation stopovers and join the crack, going out for a meal, and that's all part of it too. And in doing that, we're also supporting businesses in all the different areas we're walking in, or at least that's what we try to do, you know. So it's all aspects of people and their arrangements we try to cater for, to take pressure off them so that they know, oh, they've made it very easy for me to book my dinner, book my accommodation, etc. Yeah.
Noel, no one could sell it better than you. You're a gentleman. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. Bye-bye.
DonegalCamino.ie. This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. We had our Heritage Week quiz earlier. We'll be offering prizes every day this week. The clues we offered were: this was a prominent building during the famine. It's located in Dunfanaghy, and it's the blank house. The answer was, of course, the workhouse in Dunfanaghy. And our winners today: Mary T. Gallagher in Burtonport and Rose McGinty in Minavoy, Ballybuffet. And both of you win a heritage.ie voucher that will get you access to many heritage sites across the country. That voucher worth potentially €90 in terms of the benefits, and you can get far more than €90 out of that particular voucher given the level of use you make of it. So I hope both of you enjoy that voucher and make good use of it. Heritage Week, as we said, from the 12th to the 20th of August, Saturday to Saturday, and more prizes to be won over the course of the week. Now, getting rid of unrecycled household and commercial waste is to become more expensive in September. A new €10 levy per tonne is being applied to all municipal waste which isn't recycled. Now, we're joined on the line by Mick Quinlivan, who's a former vice chair of the Irish Waste Management Association. Mick, good morning.
Good morning, Donald. How are you?
Very well indeed. Mick, in terms of the decision to impose these increases, what practical impact is that going to have on householders in Donegal?
Well, if we take it that household waste, that people would have maybe less than a tonne, or anywhere from 750 to a tonne of bin of waste in their black bin or their messy waste, we'll call it, that would only reflect a €10 an increase, you know, €10 of an increase overall. However, the reasoning behind it is to try and take people, to try and get people to take anything that's recyclable that's going into that bin and put it into the recycling bin, and most especially the food waste. A lot of people that are not using their brown bins are putting their food waste into the black bin, and it's a problem. And the reason that the minister is panicking is that we're at 41% recycling. We have 41% recycling for municipal waste, and the target is 55% by 2025, and it's not looking likely that we're going to make it.
And this is aggregating all the waste that's being put into the various bins. Now, what sort of complicates these discussions, of course, is the fact that certainly with my waste provider in Donegal, our general waste bin is green, our recycling bin is blue, and the compost bin is brown. So we talk about green bins. And I've actually found myself having conversations with people down the country, and I'm speaking about the green bin, and the green bin is where you put all the rubbish, and the blue bin is what you recycle from. And it creates all sorts of conversations. But in terms of that, effectively, you're saying a lot of householders in Donegal are putting recyclables into what is, colour-wise, their green bin.
Yeah, well, let's say they're waste bin.
Yeah, okay, we'll call one the waste bin, we'll call the other. Yeah, because it's probably different colours for all various providers, yeah.
Yeah, and the other two bins are recycling bin. You have a waste bin, what goes into the waste bin either goes to landfill or goes to what we call recovery, which is incineration, basically. Yeah.
So there's too much going into that waste bin.
There's too much going into it, and what the government are trying to do now is trying to get people to take the waste out of it and put it into the other two bins, you know. Now, if you contaminate any of the other two bins, the whole bin is contaminated.
Yeah.
So you can't recycle anything. So they want them to do it right. They just don't want them to take stuff out of the waste bin and put it into the other two, that take the recycling out of it.
Can I give you a very clear example? And this is a conversation that was had at our table recently, because we had pizza recently. And the pizza came in a cardboard pizza box. Now, once the pizza was finished, there was quite a lot of a sort of a fatty stain residue at the base of the actual pizza box. So you could actually see this sort of brown stain. Now, is that contaminated or can that go into? Because I'm never sure. And I'm always concerned because I do know the principle. If it's contaminated, it can screw up the whole bin. And, you know, that can have a throwback onto what else is on the lorry. So when you have, say, a pizza box that's got that sort of brown, sort of slightly fatty stain at the base, is that recyclable?
Well, normally it's not too bad. Normally it's just a kind of a nearly a dampness that disappears on it. And that would be all right. That would be okay. But if there's a load of crumbs and other stuff in it, and, you know, a lot of people roll up the things and throw in the bits of crust and everything into it.
So obviously it's a matter of cleaning it off. And likewise, if you've had, say, mince in plastic packaging.
And the same with plastic packaging.
Yeah.
Yeah, give it a good wipe and put it in.
And if you have a milk carton, give it a good rinse, or an orange juice carton, the Tetra Pak, give that a good rinse as well. Just rinse them out, give them a quick wipe, you know, so try and put stuff in there that's not food waste. But also don't say, oh no, there's contamination on that, and just chuck it all into the green bin rather than go to the bother of actually doing the rinsing as such.
That's right. That's right. That's 100% correct.
Yeah.
However, there is something else connected with this that isn't kind of public knowledge yet. There's draft waste regulations, collection policy, or draft waste collection regulations in place. They're not in force yet, or they haven't come into force, but will be coming into force shortly, we think. And I think that it's going to have a very adverse effect on counties like Donegal, which are mainly rural. In the last instance, I think 70% of Donegal was deemed to be rural areas. And these regulations require everybody to get a bin for garden waste. And not require them to get it, requires the collectors to provide one. And that during the growing season, the grass season, that this bin would be collected on from April to September or October. And this would recycle garden waste.
Right.
Now, in my opinion, this is creating a new waste stream that's not currently there. But they want to raise the recycling rate.
Yeah.
And this is all recyclable. And the problem I have with it is that if you're in a big urban area and you have a little bit of rural area around you, say like you're in Dublin or even in Limerick or in, you know, any of the, but when you're in a large rural area, 70% of our area is rural, so it costs an awful lot more to collect it.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. It costs money to provide it. That's the second thing. And the third thing is you're providing a service that people aren't, I don't think that people really want.
Yeah.
Now, this can have a catastrophic effect on the cost of waste collection in Donegal.
And I'm sure in most cases, particularly in rural areas, if people are cutting grass or whatever, they have arrangements made locally to either compost it or spread it in an area where it will be composted. So, I mean, it's not, if you have garden waste or whatever, it's not going to be creating an environmental hazard. I mean, certainly, I mean, we have, I mean, in the area I live, there's a piece of ground that we use to get rid of the grass. And, you know, it's used by neighbours and it works and it doesn't get in anybody's way. So it isn't as though we are disposing of grass waste inappropriately. There are arrangements in place locally. So, I mean, I would say, I would certainly argue we don't need it as such.
Yes, that's given the cost and given the carbon footprint, because this requires enough. You know, you can collect the three bins, you can collect the caddy, and you can collect the other two bins together in one run. But to collect this bin, you will need to put out another truck.
A dedicated
and
truck.
The carbon footprint is going to be and the carbon footprint will increase by up to 25% as a result of this.
And of course, obviously, that cost is going to have to be passed on to the consumers as well. Mick, it's a really interesting one, and I'm really sorry to cut across you, but I'm afraid we've been caught by time. I do have to say thank you. And thanks indeed for just alerting us to these issues. And this becomes law in September. We'll be keeping a close eye on this, and I've no doubt we'll be speaking to you again. But in the meantime, Mick, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks very much, Donald.
Thank you, Mick. That's Mick Quinlivel there, a former vice chair of the Irish Association of Waste. Now, it's fast approaching 12 midday, so it's time for us to take our leave. Trudy O'Donnell is up next around the Northwest. I did indeed, yes. So Trudy is up next around the Northwest. But for myself, Donald Kavanagh, have a very, very good day. Thank you to Caroline and to Niamh for all their help on the show. And we're back tomorrow at 9.